And we are burning down the house here at HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Our episode for Wednesday, 15th of September, 2010. There's a lot of news that we need to catch up with, listeners. We haven't talked news all that much lately. But first, a shout out to our newest listener, Lorenzo Cervi, who's an Italian architect working in Helsinki. And to all of our friends in Scandinavia, Hrsturdamedu, Taksimike, Kulat Duskrev, which means in Skandinaviska. How's it going with you? Thanks for calling. Thanks for writing. Thanks for communicating. Joining me today is Jacob Allspector, a favorite of the program. And I am Curtis B. Wayne. You can learn more about me and the services I provide to owners and architects in quality assurance, real estate services, and constructability at http://cdanalytics.org. First up, sad news. The esteemed professor and brilliant structural engineer, Israel Sanik, has passed away. Just yesterday, I guess. Jake, yeah?
I'm not sure exactly when, but I got notice yesterday.
Just recently. And just so we have a picture of where Professor Sanik came from. After the Castro Revolution of 59, young Israel Sanik, structural engineer, who had a beginning of a brilliant career in Cuba, studying, I believe, with Candela, with the thin shell structures of concrete. The architects among us will know what I mean. But these are parabolic structures, mm-hmm. Very thin concrete, very elegant engineering.
I think he also, Taroja, it was an engineer, Taroja did a stadium there with a beautiful cantilevered roof.
So young Mr. Sanik got himself out of Cuba, and he came to New York, and he made a whole new life for himself. And starting in 1968, he taught structures at Cooper Union. He was always impeccably dressed, and he never lost his Cuban accent. Mm-hmm. It was like Ricky Ricardo on meth. I mean, he's this brilliant guy standing, almost posing at the blackboard. A calculator in one hand and the chalk in the other, writing out the equations, which, of course, structural analysis is all about mathematical analysis of the properties and the loads. And he taught thousands of young architects like you and me.
That's right.
Structural engineering. And we learned well. He was a memorable professor, and I'm sorry for his family. We will all miss him incredibly well.
Did you ever get to work with him post-graduate?
I worked with his firm. I never worked with him personally.
Yeah, I did. It was really great.
I'm sure it was. Yeah. I mean, the man had just such energy, such knowledge, and such passion for building that it was always a pleasure to then run into him in the years past. I last saw him in October at Cooper Union. And
yeah, I saw him at this. I think I saw him at the same event.
Yeah. And he
well, actually, I think I saw him in the spring.
Beautifully,
in the summer. There
beautifully
was some
dressed,
of,
but terribly frail.
Some kind
looking.
Of roof. Yeah, he looked very bad to me. And I was shocked to see him. And I went over and said hello, of course, and talked to him. And
very good. Well,
and actually, I talked to him on the phone recently because I actually asked his firm for a proposal.
Uh-huh.
And it was about 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago.
Well, I'm glad for his sake that he went quickly.
Yeah.
Rest in peace. Yeah. Now, and it, you know, that's life. I can't say that it's a crime. But the next news item is indeed a crime. Nat, if you could play track two, but keep it only about 50% up. There is a certain Harry Weiss building in Aspen, Dateline, Aspen, Colorado, August 25th. Yeah, I know this goes back a ways, but, you know, Eero Saarinen said that architecture lives in elephant time, where everything else lives in flea time. So these things
That's
move slowly.
That's a great quote. I never heard that. Terrific.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know Harry Weese, you'll probably most likely recognize his design work for the Metro in Washington, D.C. I met Harry a couple times when I was practicing in Chicago, and he was a cool guy. At the end of his life, he fell away into alcoholism, unfortunately. But there's a beautiful modernist building, circa 1972, on the campus of the University of Colorado School of Medicine. It's a tiny little building, 12,000 square feet, on a rather large 2.25-acre lot, and a real estate developer is offering the school $15 million for the property. But it means that this sweet little gem has got to be torn down, which begs the question of landmarking modern architecture. Now, this is not that old. I mean, this is within our lifetimes that we remember this. This is not something that came before, not something like a Corbu building or one of the early Ed Stone things. This is fairly recent history, and it has people up in arms, especially those who are thinking about some of the lesser Mies van der Rohe buildings that have been torn down in Chicago. And what's that group that's out to promote the preservation of modern? It's like Momo.
Docomomo.
Docomomo, right.
Docomomo. They're a worldwide organization.
Right. Yeah. An interesting group of people who passionately want to preserve good works of modernist architecture. And I would like to see this building saved, but I understand that the exigencies of schools needing money are likely to cause this to be wiped out. So other things that Harry Weese did were the Time Life building in Chicago, which is really, it's a little mediocre. I promise that in season two of Burning Down the House, we weren't going to trash talk too much about it, like I like this or not or ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. But
which is a Time Life? Which one? I'm trying to remember it.
I think it's a big steel building. It may be red, actually. We need to thank you, Dan.
Looks great.
Our Roberta's delicious margarita pizza has arrived. You know, of course, that Heritage Radio Network's studios sit in the garden of Roberta's restaurant at 261 Moore Street in the Bushwick and East Williamsburg borderlands of Brooklyn. And all of you listeners who are nearby, invited, you are encouraged to drop by. You know, if too many of you show up, we'll just give you seats in the Heritage Radio Stadium right next door. Not a problem. Plenty of seating here in the garden of Roberta's restaurant. Well, apropos of our theme today, which is the march of dollars across the landscape, and Nat, would you roll track 3, please?
Thank you.
We are burning down the house here at HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Brought to you this evening by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer, the iPad, the iPod, large format monitors, pro audio. On West 23rd Street in Manhattan, near 6th Avenue. Number one source for all things Apple. Thank you, TechServe. And with me is Jacob Allspector. Dottore, buonasera.
Grazie.
And we're talking about the ever-changing landscape. And now in Manhattan, that means the ever-changing skyline. So across from that hideous Madison Square Garden and truly brutally unpleasant Penn Station, which is entirely underground, there will be a new very, very tall building that's been approved by city planning. Dateline, late August. This is from New York Post. New York's living skyline. Vornado Realty Trust is planning a new glass and, you know, sort of screened facade in the style of Renzo Piano's New York Times building, where there's a sun-breaking kind of screen around it, designed by Cesar Pelli. And it will taper towards the top, and it will be 1,200 feet tall. So that's a, you know, that's around 110 stories.
And bulky.
And bulky, and only a few blocks away from the Empire State Building. And this has a lot of people, I got to say, a lot of people really steamed.
Especially the owners of the Empire State.
That's right, who took out a full-page ad in the August 23rd Times denouncing it as a desecration of New York's traditional skyline, with the Empire State Building being the most prominent thing in lower Midtown. Of course, the Chrysler Building's been upstaged by many other buildings.
And in terms of height, I think in terms of beauty, though.
And oh, no, there is no more beautiful building than the Chrysler Building.
It's probably the most significant.
Although the top of the GE Building a couple blocks away ain't bad either.
Hey.
You know, with the lightning bolts up there.
This actually reminds me, if I could tell everybody.
Yeah, please.
Those who are in the New York area, Gail Fenske will be giving, architectural writer and historian, will be giving a lecture tomorrow night at City College.
Thursday, the 16th of September.
That's correct. Spitzer School of Architecture starts around 6 p.m., 6:15 in the lecture hall. Public is invited, and it's on the building of the Woolworth Building.
Excellent.
You should come.
What's I was going to go to a book reading in New Canaan, but you know, twist my arm. I might
come
just
on.
Be there. What's her background?
You know, I should know better, but she's our first in the lecture series.
How do you spell her name?
F E N S K E, Gail Fenske.
Okay.
And I think she's from Chicago, actually, and is
my hometown.
That's right, and a favorite town of mine. And I think she writes about skyscrapers and the tall buildings.
Good background to have if you're going to talk about skyscrapers.
Definitely.
To have grown up in Chicago. Anyway. One of these times, we need to get a couple of advocates of the first city and the second city to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is why is architecture in Chicago so much better? I think everyone agrees.
Yeah.
And that should be, I mean, I envision this as a conversation between Bob Stern and Stanley Tigerman. Although they're both getting up there in years, so I don't know.
We can invite them.
Yeah, I just, you know, need to get around to calling Stanley and seeing how he's doing.
We have to get some serious honorariums to get those guys here.
You know, I think Stanley will do it. I don't know about Dean Stern, you know. He's a very busy man. He's got his architecture school to run and his practice.
Yeah.
and he's got his golden rake, rake that money in. Just keep those crazy.
I think he is as subject coming in. As subject to hard times as anyone, but everything is relative, of course.
Yeah, when the times were good in this last boom, his firm was very busy. So back to Vornado Tower. I mean, it's going to be just an incredible boon to the construction industry. That will employ. I would guess you'd see 600 to 700 people working on this building at its peak.
It's going to block my view of the Empire State from my office, so which is already blocked by some other hideous condo
partially
tower.
Yeah. But that is the, I mean, that is the changing nature of urban,
definitely,
of urban life.
Definitely.
I mean, yeah, you know, in New York City, if you look back across the history, there have been European people, and I don't want to talk about at this point the native Algonquians who lived in and around Manhattan, the Lenape tribes who fished and hunted, and the sub-tribe, the Manhattas, who were living here in 1609 when Hudson sailed up the Great North River, which, by the way, a good friend of mine, the editor Fred Allen, informed me it's the North River, because the Great South River was the Delaware.
Yeah.
So we get the North River and the South River. It wasn't until sometime in the 19th century that they called the Hudson River the Hudson River. Before that, it was the Great Northern River. But, there have been Europeans living continuously in Manhattan, at least since 1625, with the Dutch East India Company. And yet, we have no heritage remnants in our built environment of Dutch settlement.
In the boroughs.
There's a Dyckman house in the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
A farmhouse from the 1640s.
And I think in Brooklyn there's a couple of farmhouses.
I don't think they go back to the 1620s. It's very rare to see a building anywhere from the
1620s. Maybe we
can
get
in Salem even, you don't see
houses
that are old.
We get somebody to look those up. But I think there is... there are some relics that I was at the Brooklyn Museum this weekend to see the Andy Warhol show before it closed. And
where was that?
At Brooklyn Museum.
Oh, yeah.
But it's gone now, folks.
But you can buy the catalog.
Yeah, and they have wonderful period houses, and I think some of them were Dutch, and they were rescued and put inside.
I mean, parts of them.
Yeah, parts.
Oh, rooms from them, sure. But, I mean, if you walk down...
I didn't mean that, but there is.
I mean, if you were walking along Ann Street or Nassau Street,
no,
or New Street, you're not going to see anything that's left from
the oldest house in Manhattan is that mansion in Harlem. That
Hamilton Terrace.
No.
Oh, you mean the Morris Jamel house?
That's the one.
Well, that's from the 1760s.
That's from the Revolution. Yeah.
That was. Colonel Morris was a British officer, and he built that as his country house. And when hostilities broke out, he got himself transferred far away from those nasty Yankees, leaving the house behind. Oh, that's a wonderful house. It's the Morris Jamel house. It's around 181st Street, I think, just at the top of Morningside Heights.
It's north of City College, so it's... I think it's about 168th, maybe 60, somewhere around there, I think.
But that is definitely a house that is worthy of an excursion. It's not far from anywhere by subway. Closer if you live in Manhattan, but once you get on the express, I think the A train must go up there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But we don't see the traces of the previous, civilizations or the previous cultures. We don't see any of the original Dutch stuff. We don't see any Indian stuff. Like occasionally there's an excavation that turns into an archaeological investigation. I remember about 20 years ago, there was a condo going up in Queens in a location called Pot Cove. And it had been known as Pot Cove through all the centuries because the Indians made pottery there. Then when the British came, they made pottery there because they were nice, very rich clay banks. Mm. And as they were digging for the foundations of this not very good looking condo, they found encampments that went back 10,000 years, and they found artifacts from British encampments because there was a nice little bay, little cove there, just up from Socrates Park, mm-hmm. in that part of Queens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, we do occasionally encounter something that's archaeological, like the sunken ship that was found in down near Battery Park just a couple months ago, that they suspect was just left there as part of a landfill project.
Sure.
Back in the 1770s. But we don't see, you know, existing, surviving heritage artifacts. I mean, it brings to mind a little story I want to tell. Once upon a time, I took my family on an adventurous trip to Portugal, a little more than 10 years ago. And I was driving this rented car just along through the countryside. And there were cork trees. And I looked, you know, I had been paying attention to, all along there were low stone walls, which made sense. You could keep the sheep in. But I was noticing, architecturally, I was noticing how they were laid up. They were alternating layers courses of ashlar stone, very tall and thick layers interspersed with very thin layers. Hmm. And I realized that I had seen that pattern of stonework the week before at an excavation of a Roman site in northern Portugal near Coimbra. And then I focused back on the road, and this road was straight as an arrow all the way to the horizon, straighter than a Midwestern United States interstate highway. It was with such precision. And then I noticed the paving. It was irregular but tightly fitted black tufa, volcanic stone, which is wears very, very well, and yet it's slightly porous, so it drains well. And I had to stop the car. And I looked to the horizon on that clear day, and the sun was shining, and the cork oaks were in full leaf, blowing in the wind.
Music for this, right?
And I made my kids get out of the car. I said, look at this. This is a Roman road. We're driving on a 2,000-year-old road.
And Dad,
look at this paving. This is just like the paving that we saw last year on the Sacra Via in the Roman Forum. They said, yeah, Dad, we're not going to pat the stones. Can we get back in the car?
Right.
So,
needless to say, they're not back, interested in architecture.
We got no, they're not. No, no.
God bless them.
No, they're not. They got back in the car and rebooted the Britney Spears.
So, what are the
tape.
Future? What are the future Roman roads of our civilization?
I don't know that our roads will actually survive.
Airports, right? Runways.
Runways take a lot of maintenance, Jake. You know that.
Yeah, but
they're always having to repave those.
Yeah, but...
But, okay, the base courses will last for quite some time.
Dams. Dams.
Dams, unless earthquakes take them out.
Military installations.
Well, the...
missile silos.
You know, those missile silos have shown not to hold up too well, because concrete really isn't that wonderful as a material unless you maintain it. Mm. The dome of the Pantheon notwithstanding...
Well, it's clad in good stuff.
It's clad in lead, and it's mostly an interior concrete thing. So, when we come back to talking about this Vornado project, well, that is, I mean, that's the way of New York. And and it'll be a beautiful building. It'll be tall and it's low iron, very clear and shiny glass, the kind of glass that we didn't have 20 years ago. Free of impurities, energy efficient. A damn sight better than the New York that we grew up with back in the early 60s when New York was and you know, and our kids don't believe it when we say how things have changed, because for them it's always been the post Giuliani years, right?
And we didn't believe our parents, did we?
No.
Well, we know better now.
You
have any young
older
listeners?
We're older but wiser.
Are there any young listeners out there?
Let's just take a very brief break. It's about a minute and a half. Track four, please, Nat. Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network, brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer, Apple, iPods, iPads, that whole world, for the taking on West 23rd Street near 6th Avenue. Joined today by Jacob Allspector, architect, engineered by Nat Wiener, tagged and produced by Dan Brindell. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. A little break music was a scherzo from Love of Three Oranges by Sergei Prokofiev, one of my favorites. And the march before that was the March of the Knights from Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet. I can't say enough good about Prokofiev music. But I wanted to play that bubbly champagne-like music to go back and talk about the Hotel Pennsylvania that's going to be torn down. And it is unfortunate that despite all of the talk that we architects engaged in back in the late 70s and early 80s about adaptive reuse. Remember that? We don't hear that phrase so much anymore.
I remember it well. I was recruited out of unemployment as a student. When I was working part-time and I got laid off, I applied for unemployment, and Giorgio Cavalieri recruited me out of, that's where he got all his employees. And
really?
He was
a structural engineer, yes?
No, he was an architect.
He
was the sort of originator, at least in New York, of adaptive reuse and historic preservation, and Jefferson Market Courthouse, the Astor Library into the Public Theater.
Sure.
And many, many other things. And he was Venetian Jewish guy who left in the Mussolini era and established a practice in New York. And he was a wonderful gent, and he passed away about 3 or 4 years ago at the ripe old age of 95. And he was a great guy.
That's all right. And 95.
I learned to really, I loved old buildings, of course, but I learned to really appreciate them from him. And he also loved Mies, by the way. He was a
You can love Mies and still love a McKim Meaden White building.
Well, there are very a lot of similarities. The classical, you know, organization and...
Well, Philip Johnson, whom I encountered several times in my career so far, if Philip's not around anymore, but I am, loved to talk about how Mies was so strongly influenced by Schinkel.
Sure.
The German neoclassic architect. And certainly Schinkel has a lot to do with McKim Meaden White work, where there's an articulation of different scales of structure, and then there's applied ornament.
Yep.
So Mies took Schinkel, stripped off the ornament, and voila, you've got Crown Hall.
Well, and he used the modern materials.
You take Charlottenburg, which is a palace in Germany, strip off the ornament, do it in steel, and you've got a Miesian pavilion.
Yeah.
Or Mies did Schinkelite pavilions.
He did. A lot written about all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's useful, especially for those of you who are still studying architecture.
I am.
Or perhaps...
I still study.
So do I.
And I teach it.
That's true. Well... Yeah. Teachers must study.
They definitely must.
You can't just stand up and just wing it.
No.
But to understand that continuity is important. Now, in the case of the Vornado project, I must say that I am really disappointed that there was not some thought or effort given to a solution. Something like... what Norman Foster did for the Hearst building, where he put his thing, like it or not, he put his thing.
You mean to retain the base of the hotel
On the podium of the original Hearst building, thus maintaining the street scale that had been there, that was
keeping a piece of history.
Maintaining a lower scale at the street and then let the tower just rise. In this case, look at the pictures there. The lower portion of that facade is really quite lovely.
You're going to post these on the website?
Oh, well, we'll see what we can do.
Okay.
If not, I will post them on my...
Dan's looking at me.
On my companion blog.
Got him.
Blood.
It's a wonderful hotel. I've been to the ballroom.
Although it has seen better days. Yeah, the ballroom.
Yeah, where they've had a few events over the years, and it's a wonderful...
it's potentially wonderful, but it's seen better days.
Yeah.
It hasn't been kept up.
No, because they wanted to sell it about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and it was just a matter of time before this has happened.
One of the problems is it is a massive hotel. Hotels on this scale with, what do they say, they're 1,400 rooms or something?
I can't read it without my glasses.
Built in 1919, opened in 1919, and 2,200 rooms at its opening. As of 2008, 1,700 rooms. I mean... That is so huge. That is so impossible.
It's still pretty full. Well, it's a very popular hotel.
And it is a very difficult logistical management problem.
Yeah.
Even the Plaza Hotel at its peak was fewer than 1,000 rooms. And a lot of those rooms were rooms for servants, the little tiny rooms up.
Well, in the day when opposite the Pennsylvania Hotel was another McKim Meaden White
was the Pennsylvania Station.
Yep.
And they were set piece together.
Yep.
That, as we all, I think, these days agree, was a huge disaster for New York.
Yep. And if you're ever in the neighborhood of Penn Station and you go down into the concourse of Amtrak, you can see these wonderful black and white photographs of
what it was.
Used to be there. They're kind of sad. It's almost like they don't enshrine them. They're just kind of like put up sort of randomly on the columns.
But then the concourse space is also very sad.
Yeah, it's all sad.
It is wayfinding down there.
Do you remember the Eagles from that got put at Greenkamp?
Yes. Yes. Green Camp was an engineering camp that belonged to our alma mater, the Cooper Union. And when Penn Station was torn down, someone acquired on behalf of the school a pair of sculpted eagles. They were about four feet tall.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were quite large.
You could climb on them and straddle them.
Absolutely. And they were prominently displayed on a beautiful lawn that rose up from the river. And you could be over at the main lodge and just look across. There was a little bridge that students had built, and there they were.
Yeah.
Eventually,
up a little hill. Yep.
Yeah. Eventually, those eagles traveled back to New York, or at least one of them did, and it was in the courtyard of the old engineering building, and now it's on one of the setbacks at 41 Cooper Square.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But that is to say that ornament and the passing fashions of what we like to see and what we think is not appropriate, well, if we just throw it all away in years to come, we'll have what's the flip side of buyer's remorse? Demolition remorse, developer's remorse.
Oh.
And so I am disappointed that Vornado didn't find a way to work at least the first few two or three stories of that very nice McKim Mead and White facade into their new structure.
Yeah. Well, it's surprising that being the sole remaining McKim Mead and White structure of that era, other than the post office on the other side.
Didn't they work in the municipal building, though?
No, I mean, there's many McKim Mead. I mean, in that immediate neighborhood.
Well, yes, there's the post office.
There's the post office, and then there's a Pennsylvania Hotel.
Right.
And there was three blocks of McKim Mead and White, you know, wonderful structures. And, you know, we're all sounding very conservative here, but
there is nothing wrong with conservation of...
That's right.
Of the heritage built environment.
Of the beautiful things that were made in our past.
That's right.
Continue to inspire us. I hope the Vornado building is more worthwhile than the thing that replaced Penn Station.
Yeah. That is all, you know, that is all such of a piece where in the early 60s, it is my perception that it was the headspace of the decision makers that the city was dirty and that these old buildings were ugly and worn down, and the solution was something that was screamingly modern and for its time hip and new. And what we got was, we got the Madison Square Garden. We got a terrible train station replacing a beautiful one. But it was all of the, as again, back to one of the Philip Johnson lectures he says that it was all of a zeitgebundet, or a time-bound ethos. So, Nat, if you would play track 5, some music from that period of time.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, yeah, people tell me there ain't no use in trying, yeah. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, yeah, you'll be dead before your time is due. I know it. Watch my daddy in bed and die. His hair been turning gray, yeah. Been working and slaving his life every day. Oh, yes, I know it, baby.
me and you. Believe me, baby.
Yeah.
But I don't want to disparage.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we're back. Yeah.
We are back.
We got to get out. That's the way. Well, there was a real exodus in the late 50s and early 60s in New York City of families saying, we got to get out of this place. And they went to Levittown. They went to Co-op City. Grand Concourse became a desolate wasteland in the Bronx.
Yep.
It's taken a long time for that to slowly come back. It was the most elegant, fabulous place to live in the 20s, in the early 30s, and the march of dollars across the landscape in the form of development. It was put to these people, hey, come on, it's all new. You know, I mean, you wouldn't want to live in Co-op City, I don't think. Unless you're a shut-in, because there's no stores, you can't walk anywhere, it's way out in the swamps of the Bronx.
Freedom Land, what used to be Freedom Land.
There was Freedom Land, yeah, those rocket-shaped rides, oh yeah, memory lane.
It was shaped in the shape of the United States.
Yeah, well, we're teetering on the verge of Danny Meyer's vintage radio here, Jake. Let's not go there. But you, during the break, you were saying
One of the few good things to emerge out of the destruction of Penn Station, which was modeled after the baths of Caracalla in Rome again, but was the establishment of the Landmarks Preservation Commission, which Jackie Onassis.
That's right.
And the former
Mrs. JFK. For those of you who are younger, first she married a president, then she married a trillionaire. And
she helped. Then they all helped establish.
She was very powerful.
Landmarks Preservation Commission, which generally does really good work.
Generally is a good thing. In this case, they took a pass on the Hotel Pennsylvania, baby. You know, the power of money in New York can not be underestimated ever under any circumstances.
That's what the Dutch established, going back to the Dutch.
It's
all about trade.
It's about
resources.
Trade. That's right.
Yep.
That's right. It was a trading station for gathering beaver pelts to send back to Europe. And the Dutch really didn't want to encourage permanent settlement. It was just a trading post. They had no interest in having to administer a city or a town. It was a commercial venture.
That's right. Resources.
And
export, import.
That's right. Well, mostly export.
That three-way trade there.
Well, that eventually happened with the Triangle Trade, but that let's not get into.
We won't get into that.
To Anglo-Portuguese slaving at this moment. Thank you.
Okay.
The Portuguese slavers in Angola collecting those slaves.
The New World was an integral part of
shipping them to the New World, where the slaves.
But you were talking about
sugar
money,
cane.
And you know,
money,
which really
money
is,
goes
is
round.
Political and. The whole thing we can't lose sight of the fact that the engines of real estate in New York continue to thrive.
Well, right now the engines of real estate are kind of like...
Oh, don't underestimate them.
Well, we're waiting for the money that evaporated to recollect, you know, like a still. You know, that it all went somewhere. It's just going to take a while for it to come back and for the banks to feel comfortable lending again. Although now the equity, the capitalization for a new project is, the threshold is much higher. It used to be, you could do 80% loan to value. Now it's down 75%, which is understandable. Because the banks are holding a whole lot of what they call OREO, other real estate owned, not bank buildings, but buildings that they had to default the borrowers and take them over.
Mm. Yep.
And that will keep some of us busy for a while, for the next couple of years, trying to finish up these projects or figure out what else to do with them.
Architecture is the vehicle. And, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned Vornado, the Empire State. The Empire State was built in the early stages of the Depression.
That's
it
right.
It was finished, and it used to be called for many years the Empty State Building. In a kind of
because
a,
there was no one to move into.
That's right.
And that building went up really fast. It was like
14 months.
Yeah.
No, it was 14 months.
Yeah. Well, when you have really motivated workers who are happy to have a job.
Around the clock.
They'll work hard. That's right.
Throwing it up. And it was designed so it could with the vertical windows.
Oh, sure.
One track and the limestone.
It's
another
all modular.
Track. And,
that's right. Just runs straight up.
And
in time for that big gorilla to escape and climb it.
Yep. You know, it was a mooring mast, right? For
Zeppelins.
The top. Yep.
Yeah, they tried to dock.
Did it once or twice.
Dirigible once or twice, but it was too much turbulence up there.
A little too windy.
A lot of updraft, I think, on that building. I would not want to go through a little tunnel.
So who is the prime tenant for this Vornado building?
Well, they don't really say.
Really? So they're just putting it up? They're actually
starting. Were going to build it for Merrill Lynch, which now is part of Bank of America. And Vornado had been speaking with Merrill Lynch for years about putting up a new headquarters on that site. So I do not know who will be the prime tenant. I mean, that's a lot. A lot of space.
The other huge building, that was done similar condition
was the World Trade Center.
Well, and then also the old Bear Stearns building that was built on a big site that borrowed underground the air rights and the development potential of Grand Central Station.
Now, one thing I did want to talk about is the demands that these very large projects put on the public infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The very tall Jean Nouvel Tower planned for the site right next to MoMA,
which was cut off.
Cut off, but still it's very tall.
Circumcised.
And still it's... yes. Thank you, Moyle. Still... is a very a building with a lot of square footage on a very congested street, and the demands it's going to put on the transportation system and on water, electricity, steam, gas is very huge. In the case of the Vornado Realty Trust, part of the deal, part of the approval deal process negotiation, is that they're giving $10 million for transit improvements. Now that's proper, because a building of that size will put great demands.
So I'm curious,
on mass transit.
Are they going to fund the new Penn Station out of some of these proceeds?
I don't know that it's...
I read extensively on this, and
they did not say what it would be earmarked for.
Because Vornado also owns One Penn Plaza, which is on 34th Street, the huge slab building.
Yep.
And I'm not sure what their relation. I guess they don't own the garden site, but maybe they do. I don't know. All of these are part of. Hopefully, the new Penn Station will recapture some of the glory of the old.
Well, there's a potential. Yeah. I mean, the. The milling around space outside of the postal windows is very grand.
Oh, I love that.
On the order of Union Station in Washington.
Almost ended up there tonight, but I had my employee deliver the quarterly tax things.
Yeah,
to
that's true. It's the only place it's open really late.
Yeah.
But not all night. But it's a beautiful building.
And the people love to hang out on those steps.
Especially on tax night, it's always a party there.
Yeah,
you know, as a frequent late filer, when I lived in Manhattan, I would finish up around my tax return around 8 o'clock at night, and then I.
So where are the new monuments, which are not allowed to have steps because of the accessibility rules? Where do we hang out in the Numanians?
You can have steps, but you have to have something other, some other way to get there.
If the primary entry is the primary entry, it should be accessible. It must be accessible if it's a new building.
Yes.
Yep.
And so we lose the steps.
Yep.
We lose the experience of people watching in front of the Metropolitan Museum.
But ramps are great. Like that.
Ramps take a lot of space, though. And ramps also drive a different design aesthetic. The best ramps are Oscar Niemeyer in Brasilia or Corbu,
right?
In his various projects.
Or if we go to a recent example, the Opera House in Oslo,
by my good friend Snehetta.
Snehetta.
I'm hoping I might be able to do some work with them. I heard they're looking for a senior technical architect.
Go for it.
And my good friend from Harvard, Paul Nakazawa. Hi, Paul. Hope you're listening. He's on their board of advisors. Put me onto that. Why, my goodness, I think we've come to the end of our legal limit. This has been Burning Down the House here at HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. My guest has been Jake Allspector, brought to you by TechServe. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.